Yes, sir, it's the GI Journal again, your radio newspaper of the AEF, the paper that prints all your contributions from overseas. Men, on the target range, a bull is a clean hit. Well, here's a man who, while he may not be a hit, is definitely a lot of bull. Your original editor-in-chief, Kay Kaiser.
Well, hiya, men!
Well,
say, men, it's sure a man's size helping a pleasure being your editor again. This is your five-star final, and standing by are your five-star reporters. So then, of course, our star outside reporter, Professor Colonna, who ought to be calling in with a big story right now. Hello, City Desk.
Hello, Desk. This is Colonna. I'm overseas with the ground troops. We're on a forced march.
A forced march? Really?
Yes, and we're carrying full field packs and everything. We're really loaded.
Colonna.
Of course, some of us are loaded more than the others.
This one is from...
Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your host, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
We interrupt this program to bring to you your normally scheduled program, that is the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and that is us. And this is Jeff. This is Henry. And our guest for tonight is Mr. Steven, mystery middle name. How are you guys doing tonight?
Pretty good. Thanks for having us on again.
You guys have to be here. Steven's the one I'm having on. You guys are required. You're enlisted. You're on the roster.
We have to be here.
Unless you go AWOL and I got to send out some half-assed WTSP MP who has a weird limp to track you down. You're stuck here. You're here for the duration.
Jeff forced me to be here.
Yep. See, Jeff's our half-ass MP with a weird limp until we can afford another one with a limp on the other side. And check that box. Mr. Paul, I know you're listening to the show, and you told me that you've almost called in two or three times, but you're a little too scared, which concerns me. So if you guys are watching this on the live stream and you want to give us a call and talk to us, give us a call at 239-299-3380. I was at an event this weekend up in, Bushnell. That's a different event. Up in Parrish, Florida, and I actually had a couple of guys say, oh, I listen to your podcast while I'm at work. I watch the live stream while I'm doing paperwork. And so, you know, every once in a while, we're kind of talking about this on the OG5 podcast we just did a quick snippet of. It's like, sometimes, you know, you kind of wonder, you know, obviously if you look at your numbers, but you're like, is anybody listening? And then the times that you're actually out at an event or somewhere and someone says, oh, I listened to the show. It's like, oh, you're the guy. I was at an event like 2 years ago and I just met somebody for the first person. And he, for the first time, was up in at a Georgia event. And he was talking to one of his friends. He's like, you recognize that voice? He's like, huh? He's like, that's the guy I forced you to listen to when we were driving for 4 hours. And so it's nice when you have the opportunity to meet some people. But it's cold here in Florida. I think it's like 68 degrees. How are you all doing with the new winter upon us weather change?
Well, we had winter about 2 weeks ago on a Tuesday. It's 77 degrees today.
Yeah, because you were posting like photos like out in the snow. It was like, where are you at?
Oh yeah, that was the snowmageddon last when was that? February?
Yeah,
it was February.
Steven gets extra points for wearing the WTSP t-shirt. Shout out to you.
Actually, I'm gonna do that too.
What's that, Steve? You broke up a little bit.
Oh no, I said thank you for sending me a replacement.
Oh, yeah, you're the one. Yeah, our vendor changed their way of doing things. And funny thing is, when Jeff sent me that photo, I saw a guy on TikTok who was using the same vendor, and he was complaining that some of their shirts were having issues. But luckily for us, your that shirt that happened to was the only one that I either know of that happened to, or the only one that, you know, they reached out and touched us and said that it was an issue. I want to play something I recorded here real quick. Because I'm still reading September Hope, and I was bringing this up at the event I was at this weekend because we were doing the Von Kessinger Express, and it was funny, a lot of people there in Airborne, and not a single 101st. It was almost like someone sent out a memo, which no one did, but everybody there had an 82nd Airborne patch on their sleeve. But I was reading this in September Hope, and this is something I didn't know, and be interesting if you guys did. As with the previous day's mission, few of the glider pilots had trained co-pilots with them. They simply chose a competent-looking airborne soldier put them in the right seat, and quickly brief them on how to fly the glider. Aboard one Waco, Lieutenant James Fox, a glider pilot in the 441st Troop Carrier Group, selected a sergeant who was in charge of the bazooka team. The aircraft was loaded with a Jeep and accompanying supplies. "There's nothing to it," he told the skeptical sergeant. "It's just like driving a truck." Private Ralph Smith, a sniper with the 101st Airborne Division, had been chosen by his commander to accompany the Jeep and its driver to Landing Zone W. As paratroopers, Smith and the driver were already leery of riding in the rickety glider. As they flew along, the pilot turned and dispensed complicated instructions on how to land the Waco if he got hit. Smith and the Jeep's driver glanced at each other apprehensively and then looked at the pilot. "Sir, you can do all three of us a big favor," the Jeep driver said. "Don't get hit." This has been an excerpt from September Hope, The American Side of a Bridge Too Far, by John C. McManus. So I was amazed to find out. Now, I don't know if this is simply an Operation Market Garden thing, because they had, this is the biggest use of gliders at all time, and so maybe they took their trained co-pilots and made them pilots. But the fact that you're in the air, this wasn't discussed on the ground, but you're in the air in a glider, and the pilot turns around and says, "Hey, you look squared away. Come here. Let me teach you something. And if I die, here's how you land this thing." And by the way, something else I didn't know about gliders, they had steering wheels like a tractor. It wasn't an aileron and a stick. It was literally flying with a steering wheel, and I guess you could just slide the whole damn thing over to the passenger seat. And, I mean, could you imagine being that guy, Jeff? You're sitting behind me.
The first thing that comes to mind is, I don't, maybe they, did they turn around and pick somebody, or did they go, "Hey, I need a volunteer"? Never volunteer.
Well, I think that's why they didn't ask for volunteers. I think they literally said, "I like the way you have your collar on, or your helmet's at a jaunty tilt. Get up here." And it's just insane. And there was actually, according to the book, there's a lot of the guys who were just flying like heavy artillery and Jeeps. They were in there by themselves, and they said, but with all the downdraft and updraft and cross draft from all the planes up there, by the time they got on the ground, they were just physically exhausted from fighting that steering wheel and trying to keep their glider level so it didn't get in the way of the plane above them or below them or to the left and right. And I guess the amount of exertion put forth on those pilots was insane.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of towards the end of the war, the air war in Europe, when it just wasn't worth it to have that extensive bombardier training for, when we're sending over hundreds and hundreds of bombers to bomb Europe. Just get an enlisted guy that can go click with a toggle and drop the bombs, open the bomb bays and drop the bombs when the group leader or the, the squadron leader, whatever that lead bombardier, whenever he drops them, you drop them.
Did they start doing that?
Well, they started doing that, I think, in 1944, I want to say. But yeah, they were called togglers.
Wow.
This is when they were starting to use the Mickey device, where they would remove the ball turret, put the radar dome there. That when we were using radar to bomb through heavy smoke screens, or then weather wasn't as much a factor over the target. But yeah, it wasn't worth it to be training these guys to be bombardiers when, if the lead bombardier drops the bombs, hey, you flip the switch.
But what happens if the lead bomber gets shot out of the sky? Do they have a redundancy system?
You're going to have your contingency plans, and they may take a couple echelons and combine into one. Or fly, because they were typically in a three or four plane group.
Yeah.
So if one loses, somebody else is going to fill in. They're going to have more than one guy. But I would say probably one out of every three or four bombers only had the bombardier, So if you've got 300 bombers up there in the air, you probably only got 100 trained bombardiers, because there's just no need to have 300 bombardiers in the air, when you all have the same target. So kind of the similar instance where, hey, you look like you could do this. We don't need to train people and all that other stuff. It's, hey, you.
Well, the crazy thing is, and one of the complaints that the glider rider NCOs had was the glider pilot's job was to get them from point A to point B. Once that glider's on the ground, they were not trained in infantry soldiering. They were trained by the Army Air Corps to fly that glider. They had, basic boot camp marksmanship, but they did not go on to do infantry training or field tactics. Their job was to land the glider and make their way back to get taken back to wherever their kickoff point was. And in the case of Operation Market Garden, the NCOs are complaining because now you got 200-300 of these guys out there who aren't willing to do shit. And a lot of them end up getting put on guard duty when they start, you know, getting all these Germans. But a lot of them weren't even willing to even. And since they're technically a part of the Army Air Corps, the airborne NCOs had no authoritative power over them. So they didn't have to listen to them if they didn't want to. Some of them obviously picked up a rifle and in a survival situation. But once things died down, it was like, see you later. And they just start walking the other direction.
I just finished McManus's book, Americans at D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks a little bit about the glider corps, but I actually did not know that. But I had kind of wondered about that. Just, you know, what were these guys supposed to, because, I mean, they really weren't rated pilots.
Mm-mm. They were basically trained to fly that glider. And when you're the NCO of 82nd Airborne or 101st, and then you find out that the British equivalent to the glider pilots were cross-trained, and so their job was to land and then be a fighting man, not to retreat and wait for the next mission. They're like, why aren't we cross-training these guys? But Army Air Corps wasn't down for the cause. And that book, September Hope, has got me so interested in the whole glider side of it and learning more about them as well as the Operation Market Garden. This book just came in the mail today. I haven't even cracked it open yet. It's called 4 Hours of Fury. And because I was looking online for some more 82nd Airborne and glider stories, this is the untold story of World War II's largest airborne invasion and the final push into Nazi Germany by James M. Fenelon. So I'll be reading this here shortly. And then the book that I actually ordered during the last episode finally showed up, which is the Peleliu Tragic Triumph, The Untold Stories of the Pacific War's Forgotten Battle by Bill D. Ross. And so these will be the next two books I'm reading after I finish up September Hope. But I really want to learn more about the glider side because you don't hear a lot of people, you know, talking about in the living history world. You know, they're kind of like the unspoken word of the airborne. And from according to the statistics in September Hope, a majority of the airborne troops on the ground were actually glider riders. There was more of them than were jumping out of the planes.
It, really?
Yeah, at least during Operation Market Garden, at least. Yeah.
Huh.
There was a lot.
Well, even in further operations, you know, especially the jump over the Rhine, you know, C-47s were carrying two Waco gliders at the same time being towed right behind them. So inherently, you know, instead of just training all these troops ready to jump out of a plane, they've been stuffing guys in the back of gliders. Even same thing with the British, too, with their gliders as well. Everything in tow. Right behind them.
And it's amazing, and Steve sounds like he knows a little bit on the subject too. It's amazing to think that these wood and canvas gliders had enough updraft to carry jeeps and large artillery pieces. It's like you would think, okay, we can fit, you know, 12, 15 guys in there at 130 pounds a piece, but then they're putting jeeps and artillery pieces in there. And in that book, they were saying, these things are so flimsy that one of them, when landed during Operation Market Garden, landed in like a beet field or a potato field, and the potatoes started coming up through the cardboard bottom of the floor. And like guys are getting hit with these potatoes, and one of them, the Jeep, literally fell through the floor and survived. But these things were such rickety canvas. It's just insane to think of the amount of weight that up their wings were able to support and to get out there.
Well, so I think this is a perfect opportunity. Steve's already chimed in a little bit, but we didn't really give him the introduction that he deserves as our special guest tonight. He mentioned earlier that I forced him to be on here, and that's probably half true. Steve's become a really good buddy of mine. He's probably one of the best reenactors that I probably have ever met in. And I say that because he really knows his stuff. He's not out to dress up and look cool. The guy really knows his stuff. He's taught me so much. I didn't know how much I didn't know until I met Steve. And, you know, I think of him like my stunt double. You know, he's a little bit tougher than me, not quite as good looking. He's like a good stunt double for me. And but so if anybody just got real excited about reenacting with some of the stuff that Don was talking about, I think Steve could really give us a firsthand look on what it's like being an airborne reenactor, not walking around with an airborne patch on your sleeve, but actually going through the motions. Steve, can you enlighten some of our listeners on just some of the experiences that you've had as an airborne reenactor, some of the things that you're responsible for, and maybe talk a little bit about your recent trip to Oklahoma that you've had here just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so one of the groups that I'm associated with, and I have been for actually a little over 10 years now, is the World War II Airborne Demonstration Team, located up in Frederick, Oklahoma. We actually are based out of an old Army Air Corps base where they used to train B-25 pilots, and we have two planes of our own. We have a DC-3 and a C-47. Both are combat vets. One was owned by us, and then the other was owned by the British, and have seen combat in D-Day, Market Garden, and so on operations. But as we come together, you know, the whole group is not just, you know, a bunch of reenactors. You have, like, former service members, current service members, and people from all walks of life, and we all come together for this one cause of, you know, remember, honor, serve, where we're trying to carry on the memory and the deeds of those that came before us, especially during World War II, during airborne operations. And that's not just the paratroopers, but it's the pilots, all the support people, and everyone that was able to help us win the fight. But we do actually jump out of C-47s using more modern-day parachutes because the FAA requires us to. But, you know, a good friend of mine, he actually helps train a lot of the students that come in, you know, and the majority of them are reenactors. And then we do have those couple that, you know, it's a bucket list item. And my buddy, John Tehan, he's the drill sergeant there. He runs the guys through their days, gets them to their classes, wakes them up, checks their bumps out. But he says to all of them that this is where reenacting stops being fun. And what he's getting at is, you know, you have to be physically fit going through this course because you have to carry your load. You have to be able to get up on a platform, jump off of it, do your PLFs, put on the gear, sit in it for hours on end, getting a hanging harness, how to get yourself out of the issues, and then actually propel yourself out of the aircraft and get into a correct body position.
And that participation at a Living History event, it just brings it to a whole new level. I had the luxury, I don't know, about 2 years ago, we had an air show, and it was another group does the same thing. We kind of positioned ourselves as Living History historians out in the field where we're hidden from view, and they would come in and do the jump. Obviously, when they do the jump, they got to tend to all their gear, so they can't participate. But we kind of set it up so that once they made the jump, it looked like we were them coming into the battle. But it just brings a whole new level, and it's so damn cool, especially as a living historian, to see people doing a static line jump and seeing those 12 guys come out of those planes. And it's just, it's amazing. And I'll give you credit, man. You got some guts, because I talked to them and I found out how relatively affordable that training and participating with them was. But I got to thinking, and it's like, if I was 18 or 20, but it's like, no, I'm 38. My parents are in a business. I got a kid. I got a lot more I'm responsible for now, and there's slight risk to it. But in the back of your head, you know, all your bravado goes out the window. You know, when it's just you and your friends sitting around drinking, oh, let's go skydiving. But then when it's actually someone's seriously considering it, you start to have a gut check time. Like, would I really be able to do the jump? And so credit to you guys, and not only in preserving history, but actually doing the deed and jumping out the planes, man.
Well, and the big part about our group, too, is that the airborne contingent is just one item that we bring to shows. What you don't see is the background. So the guys that work on the planes are ground crews. You know, I work a lot on the ground crews itself, on the safety. I run the drop zone most of the time. Every once in a while, I'll get to jump out of the plane myself. But, you know, there are tons of support functions that come along with guys just jumping out of the planes, and we invite everyone down that we can. I mean, currently right now, the head of education down at the Infantry Museum at Fort Benning, Chris Lewis, he's not able to participate jump operations right now because he just had surgery on his foot, but he came out and he just wanted to be a part of the group, you know, be a part of the history, because the greatest part about being there is that we all regress back to our younger selves where we're 20, 21 years old, but we're all a bunch of nerds. We all want to talk about World War II stuff. We want to share it. And the best part, too, is that I even learned there, too, because, like, I've got guys that, you know, that turn your M42s, the, like, what at the front or man the line makes, and make them look like an actual set of M42s using original canvas and that paratroopers actually used during either, you know, D-Day or Market Garden. So, and I think it would be an enjoyable experience for you just to come out.
Absolutely. And you know, we were kind of talking about this week, and at the event I was at, guy showed up, he'd been doing it for years. I've never come across him, at least in my time. But instantaneously, kind of like when Henry joined the show, we hit it off perfectly. And the guy said, you know, one of his favorite things about going out to a Living History Weekend is you'll meet somebody you've never met in your life, but because you all have the same passion for the same topic, you like instantly, you know, you may not become best friends, but you'll have a conversation and at least enjoy each other's company. And it's, and like you said, you know, you don't really have that sort of interface with people, with maybe exception of,